Hello and welcome to the Dan Assor Show, inspiring and insightful conversations with event professionals. The Dan Assor Show is supported by headline sponsor Jonas Event Technology, an award-winning event registration supplier for organisers of trade shows, exhibitions and conferences. The show's official venue sponsor is conference and exhibition venue Business Design Centre, which has just become B Corp certified, showing its high standards of social and environmental impact. The show is also supported by TF Connect, Tarsus Group, Terrapin and 19 Group. Today, my guest is Johnny Baines, a partner at Plural Strategy, a strategy consultancy for the media, information and technology industries. Johnny has over 25 years of experience in the media and event sectors and leads Plural's events practice, working with leading corporates, investors and venues in the sector globally to drive growth and innovation. He is also a keen musician and plays in the company band. The conversation includes merger and acquisition trends in the live events and event technology sectors, moving beyond the live event, the continued appetite of private equity in the B2B live event sector, trends and opportunities in event technology, how important it is for event businesses to continue to embrace technological innovation, how to overcome the challenges faced on the digital transformation journey, insights into the process Johnny goes through with clients on the design of a new event, the concept of customer taxonomy, and what Johnny loves most about working in the events industry. Johnny, for those that aren't aware, I always just get my guest in front of me just to give a brief introduction as to who you are. Obviously, you're a consultant at Plural Strategy, but just bring that to life for us, please.
Plural is a strategy consulting firm founded 9 years ago with three people. We're now 70 people in London and New York. What we do, strategy consulting, really falls into two buckets. Bucket one being M&A, typically commercial DD for buyers of businesses, and strategy, which covers a whole number of different types of assignment, but typically focuses around growth levers. And we're sector focused, so we typically work in the media information and technology space.
Sure.
That's us.
Okay, thank you. And I know specifically your media and events, obviously technology falls within that as well. And to say that it's been an interesting few years in that sector will be an understatement. And we're going to talk about some of that in a minute. But I want to start off with, again, it's been very interesting. We've come through the pandemic, and there's been lots of activity in the M&A sector, mergers and acquisitions. I should say in the live events B2B sector specifically. Notable examples, Informa's acquisition of Tarsus a few months ago, subsequent acquisition of Winsight. We've had Providence and Searchlight Capital's acquisition of Hive. Were you expecting that level of activity sort of post-pandemic? Has any of it come as a surprise? Give us your view.
Well, I was actually expecting it to come earlier.
Okay.
If I'm honest, I'm sort of waiting for it to come back, partly obviously because that helps our business. But I genuinely did think, it was busy telling my partners, that M&A would come back in the sector a bit earlier than it has. So I kind of was expecting it. And I think it surprised me somewhat how long it took for confidence to come back.
Okay.
To the buy side, if you like, and I think, you know, that has essentially triggered the level of activity that we're now seeing. I think obviously businesses are trading again, but for Providence and Informa in particular, obviously they were in a position to see how businesses were coming back firsthand.
Sure,
and I think that enabled them to feel confident to make these investments.
Yeah. And what about the sort of valuations? Again, you could speak specifically or not, but lots of discussion around the valuations that have happened for those specific deals, and just generally in terms of the multiples that these sort of businesses are going for. Any views on that? Surprises? Think they're pretty on par? What's your opinion?
I don't think we're seeing anything dramatic overall, sort of like for like versus, say, 2019. We're seeing similar sorts of businesses going for similar sorts of multiples. I think the big exception, the big change, is businesses that have a mixed focus across different media assets. So as you probably remember, you know, there was such a heavy focus on the trade show model before the pandemic. And now investors and organizers are much more keen to embrace a broader set of, you know, channels, particularly digital, as a way to reach their customers. And I think previously, those kinds of assets would often be discounted.
Yeah.
So they would attract a lower multiple than the face-to-face asset. And, you know, that's the big thing that's changed. I think that is no longer the case. And I think we'll see some quite sort of juicy multiples coming through in the next sort of 12 to 18 months, particularly with that in mind.
Sure, because it's interesting. I've definitely seen a distinct shift, I think, in some of the language that lots of the companies in this space, specifically B2B live events, media companies, in terms of the positioning. As you say, sort of previously, maybe 3-5 years ago, they described themselves as very much events businesses. Now there's definitely been a shift in describing themselves as, you know, data-driven businesses or community-led businesses. Is that a trend that you're seeing? Do you think that's a trend that's going to continue?
Yes, I do. I don't think it's easy to execute and pull off, but I do think it's inevitable that, you know, businesses that by definition have such a strong position in their vertical, if they own a leading event, that they're naturally going to feel the need to move beyond touching that community or that vertical, you know, more than once a year. And I think there is a real danger if they don't, that, you know, someone else comes along and eats their lunch. And I think we've already seen that, you know, sure, many times. Smaller businesses start up with that kind of format, more of a sort of 365 and an event approach. And if you're the incumbent with that coming up against you, that's not very comfortable. So I think we will see more attempts by the sort of traditional event organizers to institute more vertical plays.
Sure. And I guess it gives confidence to independents as well, you know, startups, people that have been going for a few years that are looking maybe to realize value within 3-5, whatever years it is, that there's notable and significant acquisition activity. You know, sort of pre-pandemic, I guess there were lots of deals were going to get done that then obviously suddenly stopped. And as you say, people have been waiting to see how those have developed. Talk to me, I guess, about the sort of, you know, we've spoken about some of the big guys in this sector, Informa, Tarsus, Hive. What about sort of the other tier of companies? What are the sort of trends that are you seeing at the moment within the media and live events industry, maybe just underneath the big guys?
So still, you know, a lot of appetite for M&A. And I think it's quite an aggressive field right now.
Yeah.
Bringing the smaller guys in up against the bigger guys. Obviously, the bigger guys, if they decide to go for something, are quite hard to compete against.
Sure.
But it's intensely competitive for strong assets. Looking for an exit right now are in a really good position because there's quite a big field of potential buyers, both private equity backed and listed.
Yeah. And actually coming to that point, the role of private equity within this space, from my perspective and from what I'm reading and other conversations I've had, that, you know, the last 15 years, predominantly, I guess, private equity has seen live events, if I just talk focus on that, the B2B live event sector is quite attractive. Why do you think that is? And do you think that's going to continue?
I think, yes, it is going to continue. Back to the point you made at the top, you know, it surprised me how long it took for confidence to come back, you know, particularly amongst the investment community, having been such a hot sector up till 2019, 2020. It did surprise me that some potential investors seem to have walked away altogether,
yeah,
from the sector. It just too risky and maybe it won't come back fully and so on. It has come back fully, clearly. And so I think the things that attracted investors to the sector, the high quality of revenues, the visibility, leading position in a sort of marketing, in the marketing mix, all those things remain. And I think, if anything, you know, as businesses have sort of done their best to learn the lessons of the pandemic, I think we'll in a lot of cases, we'll see them becoming more robust business models. I don't think we're quite there yet, but you know, the sector as a whole has embraced the need to become robust. Clearly, everyone was a bit shocked and taken by surprise at how little they could do to serve their customers. And I don't think anyone wants to be in that position again.
Sure.
So I think, generally speaking, yes, the appetite for these kinds of assets, it's coming back. And I don't see it will be different to how it was pre-pandemic.
Sure.
Hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just going to take a brief pause to tell you a little bit about the Dan Assel Show headline sponsor, Jonas Event Technology. Jonas Event Technology, or JET, are an award-winning supplier of event registration dedicated to providing event organizers with a seamless registration experience and excellent customer service, as proven by their current NPS score of 71. JET provides a full registration solution for trade shows, exhibitions, and conferences, removing the stress of event registration so that event organizers can focus on making their next event the best yet. Visit jonas.events for more information.
You mentioned the word robust there a couple of times. What do you think businesses can be doing to make their business more robust? You know, maybe that they haven't been doing before.
So, I mean, it starts with the question, how can we serve our customers if, you know, as well as or instead of, you know, rather than just relying on this single point of contact we have with them? And what do we need in order to do that? And it may come down to a certain ability to deliver content, for example, or different formats, like the format that we're on now, a one-to-one, which translates perfectly well to digital. But I think the common theme that organizers experienced was that they didn't know what to serve their business, their verticals, their customers with, because they just didn't have enough information on them. You know, the depth of information that a event organizer has versus, say, you know, a marketing services business is extreme. And if you just take the example of a one-to-one event organizer, the level of customer information they have to have in order to operate and bring and, you know, make relevant matches, and the difference between that model and say a trade show model, which might have an email and a couple of other things, but doesn't have the ability to service that customer outside of a trade show because they don't know enough about their preferences. So I think that's probably the big takeaway, and the thing that's probably the single biggest factor I expect to sort of transform these businesses over the years.
Sure. And are you seeing, just finally on the M&A question, are you seeing any other trends in M&A within the media and live event sector that we should be taking a note of?
I think the biggest one is, as I say, this kind of willingness to embrace a greater variety of models. Okay. So both different types of live model, perhaps more interest in intimate, smaller models where they're delivering something very valuable, for example, but also this, as we were saying, this tendency to be looking at digital models as well.
And I want to turn to, because obviously you deal within the technology space, I'd like to turn to, again, there's been lots of activity from an M&A perspective recently. Blackstone's acquisition of Cvent, which happened in March, Hopin, and some of their assets were acquired by RingCentral recently. Can you comment sort of more broadly on the trends and opportunities in event tech that you're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to get distracted by some of the headlines, you know, particularly brought about by the rebasing of demand for virtual. Which, it sort of surprised me how it seems to have taken a lot of people by surprise. almost in the same way that, you know, the pandemic took live events organizers by surprise. Whereas I think it felt almost inevitable that if live was going to come back, then virtual had to suffer to some extent. And indeed, that is what has played out. But I think leaving that aside, the opportunities, you know, the sort of structural outlook for event technology is really strong. And it was developing fast pre-pandemic, and I think it will continue to do so. So what we've effectively experienced is just this slightly odd blip. And as the effect of that blip sort of recedes, the need for event technology is still strong and growing. People want to deliver more efficiently, and there's a lot of things that need to be done by organizers, and technology is going to be one of the biggest tools in helping those transformations take place. So I do think it's a good outlook for the sector.
Sure. And obviously event tech is a lot more than just virtual event platforms, right? And I guess what we're seeing is a correction in the market. A lot of the virtual only players or only sort of double down on virtual, but didn't have a proposition that they could implement when we came back to live, have obviously suffered. Do you think potentially that was Hopin's challenge? Obviously huge valuations. They weren't invested in the event sector sort of previous. You know, they were sort of born during the pandemic, even though it was a coincidence that happened. Obviously, they launched in 2019. But do you think that's why there's been a correction?
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses were very heavily exposed to the virtual format.
Yeah.
And if that was really the key thing causing, you know, driving their growth during those sort of 3 years without any live offering, then I think that's left a lot of businesses a bit stranded in this position where live has come back so strongly. I think the businesses that have something which is more transferable, such as, you know, going back to what we were saying about data, yeah, customer data, and the ability to help organizers make that work better, I think that's those kinds of businesses are going to be in a much better position.
Sure. How does a company go from a $7.8 billion valuation to, you know, reported maybe $15 million for the assets that were sold? I mean, it's for people that aren't in the know and don't work in these sort of industries or in M&A, it's sort of mind-boggling. Obviously, I know you know you're not involved in the deal, so you're sitting on it as an outsider as well. But you've been in. Is it just a case of, you know, in 2021? The venture capitalists were just, you know, they saw the future as all virtual, and all they just they I don't know what happened. Give us a view. As
yeah, it is exactly that, and not just venture capitalists. Yeah. I mean, the number of times I heard, not from event organizers typically, yeah, but from you know, professionals who are not that far from the sector, and certainly investors, the idea that live face to face was permanently gone or changed forever or diminished in some way, and that virtual was here to stay. And of course it is in some respects. Here we are, you and I talking on that format, and perhaps we wouldn't have done this in 2019. Sure. but clearly for larger formats, you know, where the vast majority of the marketers wanted to put their budgets back into, you know, there was very little appetite for marketers to carry on with virtual. Clearly that's left the market with not a lot of fuel. But, you know, back in 2020, 2021, yeah, I don't think anyone was going through that sort of thought process and saying, well, are marketers really going to want to stick with this format? And sure enough, that it's sort of played out as I think many organizers themselves would have expected. So yes, it surprised us at the time that those kinds of valuations were being attracted, because of course that means there is an expectation of future earnings growth on a similar scale, which we couldn't see envisage playing out at all.
Sure.
You are listening to The Dan Assell Show, inspiring and insightful conversations with event professionals. The Dan Assel Show's official venue sponsor is conference and exhibition venue Business Design Center, which has just become B Corp certified, showing its high standards of social and environmental impact. For more information, visit businessdesigncenter.co.uk. Be notified first about new episodes by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms, and by subscribing to my YouTube channel. Search Dan Assor.
Sticking with, I guess, moving on to digital, the pandemic accelerated digital transformation in the media and live events industry, as we just spoke about. How important is it still for businesses in these industries to continue to embrace technological innovations, and what opportunities do you think these innovations present?
I think it's inevitable. It is important and inevitable at the same time. You know, going back to what we were saying before, I think there is going to be more of a trend of organizers looking to strengthen their vertical plays, if you like, no longer content to just have a single asset, albeit a very strong asset, in a given sector. And so I think vertical plays are going to become more common. You know, Informa Tech being an example, clearly that's been around for a few years now, but I think we're going to see more plays of that nature across the industry of a business saying, we really want to wrap ourselves around a particular vertical and not rely on a single position,
sure,
in that vertical. And as you know, the way to do that is through embracing technology, because it's actually quite hard to, it's very easy to say and very, very difficult to deliver on, for particularly for a very large business, because you need something called a single customer view, really, which, you know, we've been talking about in the industry, haven't we,
forever,
for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But I think there is really quite a strong desire to have that now, but it's not easy to deliver or to carry off without quite a lot of help from technology.
Yeah.
So I think it is inevitable that's going to happen.
And so what are some of the steps that a company can make on that journey? I guess you've got, there's two types of companies, right? You've got a big company with lots of legacy systems. You know, it's easier, you could say, that if I'm starting a business, I can choose a best of breed solution and sort of build it from the bottom up. But if I'm sitting there and I've got lots of legacy systems, you know, history is littered with digital projects that have gone a bit awry, people obviously investing hundreds of millions of pounds. Give us your view, some of the conversations you have with some of your clients. As where do they start, or what are they doing?
So it is quite tough, I think, if you're a big business with legacy systems. And from the conversations I have, it sounds like it's like having sort of several teeth removed at once in terms of the pain.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's still quite early days in terms of, you know, saying whether there's a payoff or not. But, you know, in the nuts and bolts of it, I think that is probably where you start. You start with the customer. Who is the customer? Because it's only starting with a customer that you understand how you're going to best serve that customer. Otherwise, you're sort of guessing. And if you guess well, then great, well done. But you know, if you have that data, you know who your customers are, or you have the ability to get to know who your customers are, I think that has to be the start point. Who are they? What do they need? How can we service that? And that is, I mean, it's sort of easy to say, but it does involve quite a bit of technological architecture and probably change for legacy businesses.
Sure. And I guess there's change not just in the technology, but the personnel required as well. So the types of people. Are you seeing, again, with the clients that you work with, are you seeing they're bringing different types of staff and internal talent recruitment to sort of fulfill that change?
Yes, although at very differing levels across the industry, there's a real spectrum. You know, even amongst businesses that probably, you know, you and I would think as sort of leading businesses, in the event sector, I think you can see sort of dramatically different approaches. You know, just to take an example, a highly centralized approach, attempting to do something similar across a very large, diverse portfolio, potentially global portfolio, versus, you know, a pick and choose approach, say, or going after particular verticals and saying, right, we think this is a sector that really requires this. So the kind of resource and investment you need to make is obviously very, very different across those kinds of approaches. So I think, yeah, as you were saying, you know, a lot of money has been spent, and I'm not sure all of it has been spent especially effectively, but I think inevitably you do require skill sets which weren't necessarily in the business previously. I think another approach we've seen is M&A. So, you know, actually, instead of hiring people into the business, you acquire a business and take a very good look at what they're doing, and learn from the businesses you've acquired.
Sure. Okay, thank you. And obviously, M&A is not the only route to growth. We know organisers are still keen to grow organically and launch new events and media. Can you, and I know that Plural Strategy specifically do a lot of work, and you do in this area. Can you give us an insight on the process you go through with the client on the design of a new event and launch? Because obviously, we just see as consumers of this and people in the industry, oh, a brand new shiny event's launched. Doesn't happen overnight, right? So it'd be good to get a view if a customer sits with you and says, right, yeah, I've got a view of where we want to go with this, but can you help?
Yes. And here I would distinguish between, you know, a clone launch,
okay,
and a sort of complete greenfield launch, whereby, you know, the clone process is it's a pretty well trodden path, and I think, you know, once you've got the backing, hopefully the backing of your supplier base, they've asked you to take them to a certain geography, and you've scoped out the market and competitive position in that geography, you know, a look at a calendar, you know, that's not too complex. A clone, I mean, I'm oversimplifying it dramatically, but it's the kind of process that we would go through to scope that out. It takes weeks rather than, you know, months and years.
Sure.
for a greenfield, that is a longer lead time, and typically requires, particularly if there's anything new about the format or the sector, or if it's perhaps a disruptive approach with incumbents already in place. Certainly the work we would do around that is going to require quite a lot of research, speaking to potential customers, looking at the parts of the market you're trying to address. You might be able to look across the globe and see, you know, other models and go, okay, we quite fancy that what X has done over there. Is that something we could replicate part of? So, you know, you might beg, borrow and steal from other models the best of the sort of greatest hits that you can see doing well in a particular sector. I don't think there's a sort of a one size fits all, because clearly the format you eventually decide to go with has to be well matched to the customer base you're trying to attract. And so, you know, the one thing we would always start with is, you know, it comes back to the customer, speaking to the customer and what's going to drive value for them, what are they after, and building it around that. And then you probably have a core customer group, which typically might be the most senior buyers that you're after. And then you try and build around that. What are the dynamics? Who are the suppliers and other buy sides that will want to that will be attracted to that group? And you build the event sort of audience dynamics in that way. And that should give you the different constituents that you're trying to attract to the event. Once you've market tested that, that's when the hard work begins, you know, where what's the venue going to be? Can we get a slot? And so on.
Could you give us an example of I guess, a project that you've worked on with a client with regards to a new launch.
We were involved in a what appeared to be a pretty standard growth strategy project, looking at a portfolio in the US, a portfolio of quite focused sort of content and slash educational events for the marketing community, quite focused on marketing technology. And what became apparent was this community had, A, was very, very senior in the industry, and B, had a really strong appetite to network on a peer-to-peer basis with each other, learn with each other, problem solve with each other. They had a very high regard for our clients' ability to do that and the content and sort of content moments they were getting. And we discussed with our client the ability to launch something a lot bigger off the basis of this, as it is a model we've seen successfully executed in a number of sectors, starting with that core of really senior sort of buy-side attendees. And so we discussed this with them, and they were keen on the idea. And so we set about building out what that event could look like, building around that core of CMOs and what they needed. It turned out, you know, unsurprisingly, that a lot of suppliers were keen to target them, as well as a lot of other marketers, you know, who wanted to be around them, learn from them, and so on. And you get the sort of cascade effect, which allows you to build out, you know, a fairly sizable event profile. And ultimately, we got someone called Christian Mucha, who was the former organizer of DMXCO, which is still one of the largest marketing technology events in the world in Germany. And he came in as CEO of this new event, which didn't at the time have a name. They came up with a name, Possible. That wasn't a plural invention. We looked at the potential venues, decided that Miami was probably the on balance the best. It wasn't easy, but I think Miami right now is having quite a resurgence in terms of particularly the technology sector, and it seemed like the right place. Plus, they had availability in the calendar, which always helps. And the community themselves were keen. It was certainly one of the top names they came up with. And it launched in April, was very successful. Elon Musk was a keynote speaker, and he was interviewed by a lady who turned out to then 2 weeks later be announced as the CEO of Twitter.
Right. Which is now obviously X.
Which is now X. I'm not allowed to say Twitter.
Which is now X. Okay, great. So that's a good illustration of how you work with a client who wants to build out a new proposition. So it is possible, but I guess in summary, what we're saying is we need to look at all the different constituent parts that make up the stakeholders of that event really carefully.
Yeah, it always starts with what is the jam in the middle of the donut, and how do we build out around that? How do we define the sort of the real core value proposition? And I think sometimes it is the case that you don't want to build out around that. You want to keep that as a really sort of focused proposition. But I think the most successful events are able to effectively build around that. And that's what happened with Possible.
Sure, thank you. If I say the words customer taxonomy to some people, they might leave the room. They might not know what I'm talking about.
But one of my clients said, "Do you want me to stuff an owl?"
Right. And so, well, yes, I can sort of understand that. But having done a bit of research myself, I can understand the importance. But for someone listening, what is the concept? Can you explain the concept of customer taxonomy? And then we'll talk about its significance and sort of understanding customer behavior. But just give us the Johnny definition.
It's the way that we capture information on our customers.
Yeah.
It's the architecture for capturing that information. And it can be as simple as name plus email, or it can go right down into preferences and how many dogs you have and when you like to walk them. And I'm not exaggerating. I've seen, you know, attendee information where the kind of richness you get, it might sound irrelevant, but actually, if you have a, for some models, that's a conversation sure. starter with a potential supplier. So it's the architecture you have for capturing that information. And I guess why it's relevant is, going back to what we were saying earlier, I think a number of organizers felt that perhaps that architecture wasn't sufficiently, just wasn't big enough. It wasn't rich enough to enable them to be more agile in communicating with their customers, understanding their preferences, and ultimately being able to serve them better. Because of course that information is how you understand how best to serve your customers.
Sure. So what we're saying is it's again going back to the data angle and element of the conversation before, it's making sure that we understand, you know, what's in it for someone. If they're looking to come to a trade show, why should they come? What are their preferences? What they want to do when they get there? And I guess customers can mean different things in this. So it could be a delegate to a trade show. Could it also be relevant to an exhibitor? So what their journey is as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's equally applicable. Understanding what they're looking to, who they're looking to meet, when they're looking to meet them, what they're looking to sell to them. It's I would say, you know, for most organizers, that piece of the, that side of the equation is probably better looked after historically than the buy side. But I don't think anyone would have said that it was perfect. That was certainly better populated, I think, than the buy side of the equation.
Sure. And can we just sort of expand on how we feel it helps businesses improve their marketing strategies and customer experience? And maybe you might be able to bring to life some examples of some work you've done in this area.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, at an obvious level, if you know your customers, you're able to serve them better. But you know, what does that actually mean? Well, in practice, it can be anything from, you know, how a potential visitor to an event interacts with marketing, with content, what they click on, how long they spend in certain areas of a website or a content page. So you get to understand their preferences from that perspective, what they're interested in terms of solutions, and therefore for a solutions provider, that's clearly very helpful information. Right down to, you know, how you might want to design an event. I think we're going to increasingly see, you know, matchmaking in one form or other becoming more and more important in events. Now we have the ability to make really effective and valuable matches for event participants. I think they're just going to want that more. And suppliers, you know, seeing the value of it, are going to want it more. Buyers, seeing how it saves them time, are going to want it more. So I think and how do you do that properly? Well, you obviously need a proper taxonomy. You need that information in your system to be able to help people to match effectively. So I think inevitably this is going to become more and more important, not solely for the purpose of, you know, matchmaking, but for more generally serving customers in a more precise way, if I can say that.
Sure.
More targeted way. And so I think you were asking how have we helped businesses do that. So just to take an example of a recent piece of work, I think our customer had a sense that there were a very large number of people in their taxonomy, in their customer base, that they didn't really know what they were there for. It was more obvious with, say, about half of them, and then another half they were kind of question mark, a big gray area. Not even sure if they're there to as suppliers or buyers, because we don't have the information. All we have is a company name and a person name. And so we went through a fairly painstaking process of identifying who people were. And we ultimately were able to segment this sort of amorphous group into something much more targeted and help our client to deliver what that group wanted. It turned out that a very large number of them were smaller suppliers who were struggling to find value by getting a big stand, but were very excited at the prospect of having targeted meetings with people and would pay for it. So it was kind of money on the table, being left on the table, because we didn't know who the customers were.
It's always good to sort of bring the human element of my guests to life. And you've got a quite interesting story to tell on the fact that I understand that you are part of you're a musician and you're part of a Plural Strategy band, which seems very different to your day-to-day work. Tell us about that. Tell us about how you got into that, why it's important to you. Are there any parallels to being a musician to the industry that you work in?
Ooh, I have to think about that. Yeah, Plural's had a band since our first year, which is just, I think, a function of the fact that I and one of the other partners were both in musicians in our past lives. Well, we still are musicians. And so we were keen to gather around us anyone who could so much as sing as a note.
Yeah.
And it, you know, we discovered that actually there were a lot of closet guitarists or bass players in our staff, yeah, who had been very quiet about it. And as soon as we said, right, you're in the band, they got terribly keen. So it was a great, it's been an annual event, the band playing, normally around the time of Plural's birthday, which is in the spring. And as well as that, I'm in a jazz band, which plays once a week in a club in Brook Street.
Yeah.
And that keeps me sane when I'm working too hard.
Right. What instrument?
Having an outlet like that.
What instrument is your forte?
The piano is the one I played since a kid.
Yeah.
In the jazz band, I'm playing the drums, and in the Plural band, it looks like I'm playing the drums. I've been playing the drums so far, right, and we can't find anyone else who wants, right, to play the drums. So
interesting.
It's me.
Okay, so you're definitely my first musician guest from within the industry. So that's the first. And just finally, Johnny, what do you most like about the work you do in the business and the sort of sectors that you operate in?
So, I mean, I personally focus quite a lot on the event sector. Plural, as you know, is sort of more broadly spread across media and technology. Working in events, I've found endlessly fascinating. Probably could have done without some of the excitement of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
But kind of more broadly, it's obviously such an entrepreneurial sector. It's and so fascinating from that perspective. There's always new businesses turning up, which, you know, a lot of which I've never heard of, and there they are, and they're big, and they're doing amazing things. And you go, wow, you know, placing big bets on certain trends and it paying off. It's always really exciting to see that kind of thing happen. Obviously, there is the fact of it being face to face, which is,
sure,
which is nice and enjoyable. But I think, you know, the dynamics of the industry itself are probably what I find most interesting. And as I say, the entrepreneurial nature of the decision makers.
Sure. And what's the most favorite event or an event that you typically attend each year, and why? What do you like about it? So if you put yourself in the position as a consumer of an event, maybe it's a musical one, I don't know, it could be any. Is there one that you always go to, and why do you go to it?
You know what, there isn't a single event, yeah, I always go to. I naturally find myself in Las Vegas quite a lot of the time.
Sure.
Which is nice, because it feels like, you know, a bit of a home for the industry, for the trade show industry. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I think what I find, again, going back to what I find so exciting, is probably the event I like most is the one I've quite often the one I've been to most recently, because I've seen something new or exciting there, or, you know, a different take on things. So it's constantly evolving, my answer to that question. Sure.
That's fair enough. Cool. Thank you. So, Johnny, wish you the best of luck with the band, the business. We look forward to seeing more developments, obviously, in the events industry and your thoughts on those. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Dan. Nice to see you.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. The Dan Assel Show is grateful for the support of headline sponsor Jonas Event Technology, venue sponsor Business Design Centre, and event industry supporters TF Connect, Tarsus Group, Terrapin, and 19 Group. Be notified first about new episodes by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms, and by subscribing to my YouTube channel. Search Dan Assel.